Hello again from Holden Village. Today is June 16th, the year 2000, and in the fireside room this morning, the Bible study continues with Bob Ekblad. His series is "The Promise Threatened but Claimed," and today's session will be "Life in the Wilderness: The Perils of Unbelief and Temptation." This is tape number 2000-5.
I think we can maybe get started with our last session here. We can roll the tape. Today's session is our fifth in a series on Exodus, and it's specifically on the perils of life in the wilderness. The wilderness being the place that we get to after we've been saved or liberated by God. Yesterday we saw how God's salvation and deliverance, political liberation, was accomplished in Exodus 14. By all these dramatic events, the people were penned in and had nowhere to go, and suddenly, God shows up right at the last minute and blocks, kind of throws the armies of Pharaoh into confusion, and opens a way right through the middle of the sea. It's this impossible possibility that happens, right? So the people who were once slaves suddenly find themselves on the other side, and there's this great song of salvation, right? If you guys could turn to your Bibles to chapter 15. And someone can read for us verse 30 and 31. It's like the book of Exodus could end right here. Chapter 14, verse 30 and 31. I guess I said 15 or 13.
Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great work that the Lord did against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord and believed in the Lord and his servant Moses.
Okay, so here we have what many pastors and evangelists are looking for, right? The conversion of a people. And that's followed by this incredible song of Moses, which is a kind of a worshipful song of celebrating the victory over the forces of evil. There's been all this spiritual combat going on in the first 14 chapters of the book. The forces of the Lord, represented by this weak figure Moses and Aaron, are battling against this huge empire where Pharaoh is the figurehead, and the battle rages and rages, and it gets more and more intense. And here the Lord wins and shows that ultimately God has the authority over the principalities and powers. So there's this incredible celebration. What's amazing about the book of Exodus is this is almost, while this liberation process is critical, here we're brought to a place where it's like a whole new beginning happens, and a whole new life in a new location. And if we get to the very end of the Song of Moses and the Song of Miriam, which we don't have time to read, could someone read for us just verse 22 alone?
Of
15.
Then Moses ordered Israel to set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur.
Okay. No, that's okay. Keep going here.
They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water.
All right, so for the first time, the Israelites are now in the wilderness. And the first day we talked about, or the second day we talked about how the wilderness functions in the scriptures. Does anyone remember about, I mean, anyone here during that first or second week or second day when we talked about the wilderness according to the scriptures? I'll just review it really quick. The wilderness is a place of exile. Okay, it's the place, if you look at all the occurrences of Midbar in Hebrew, the very first occurrences are with Hagar, you know, where she's cast into the wilderness. And then the second occurrence is actually Hagar and Ishmael, who are both cast into the wilderness, where they find that there's just no hope at all, and they cry out. Okay, so the wilderness is a place of desolation, where people are cast, and also where people do cry out sometimes, and where God shows up. Okay, in both cases, God came and rescued Hagar and Ishmael, her son. So the wilderness is a place of desolation, but it's also a place where God comes to people, revealing, meeting them, providing for them. We talked about how Moses, when he met God, when God met Moses at the burning bush, he was at the very bottom of the wilderness, or the deepest, furthest depths of the wilderness. You know, the Hebrew says behind the wilderness, you know, which is this, it's maybe another way of saying, you know, he bottomed out big time, you know. And so here, now Israel is following, the whole people are following Moses into the wilderness. The wilderness, there's a third dimension of the wilderness, which we're going to find developed in the rest of Exodus, which is the wilderness as a place of rebellion and unbelief because of the difficulties. Difficulties of life in the wilderness inspire rebellion, inspire unbelief, inspire all sorts of desires to get away from that place and to go back to a place of security. So it's a place of trials and temptations. This is expressed really well in Deuteronomy 8, chapter 8, verse 2. It says, "Remember the long way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, in order to humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commandments." Okay, so, and if we remember Jesus also, after his baptism, you know, something we forget so often, you know, we think of baptism as a place, as coming into the community of faith. It's a celebration. You know, we celebrate this moment when a young child or an adult becomes a member of the community. And so baptism looks like an entryway into more security, right? You're coming from out of the world, out there in the world through baptism into this secure community. And oftentimes that's what it is. It's the rite of passage into a place of total of less ambiguity and more security. Whereas in the gospel accounts, and if we look at the Red Sea as Israel's baptism, in a sense, you know, going through the waters, what we have with the post-baptism is the Spirit drives Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Okay, so, you know, this just the baptism is just the beginning of our problems with this model. The Desert Fathers understood this well in the first three centuries. Many, many people said they wanted to follow Jesus in a literal way, and so they went away from all the distractions of where they were, the cities and villages of the ancient, the first three centuries, and took off into Egypt and went into the wilderness and lived in caves, and there were spiritual fathers and spiritual mothers who they would go to and be mentored by. But their objective in going to the desert was to face the devil, the evil one, directly, and to struggle, because they understood that it was that place of one-on-one combat and struggle that, in a way, they saw it as an easier place. It was easier. They saw the desert as a place for the weak, like themselves. They didn't elevate themselves as these holy roller monk types. They rather saw themselves as needing to be go away from all the other distractions so they could have a direct face-to-face with the evil one, knowing that God would be with them, you know, as God was with Jesus through the ministering angels and as God was with the Israelites. So anyway, here we are in the wilderness with Israel, and we're about to discover some things about what, you know, what people are up against. There's an interesting side here, which I was thought about last night. You know, Moses' murder of the Egyptian taskmaster led to his exile, led to him being having to flee as a fugitive. And when God met him, he said, instead of God throwing on the handcuffs and taking him back to Pharaoh, you know, which is what he feared, you know, the Hebrew text says he feared, Moses was afraid, and he hid his face, which brings up two verbs that are used also right at the moment when he murders the Egyptian. You know, he was afraid, he looked this way and that, and he hid the Egyptian's body in the sand, right? So a careful reader will note that. But what does God say? He says, no, I have seen. It's just like this real emphasis of God seeing. I've seen the oppression of the people, you know, and I've heard their cries, and I'm sending you. So God is in total solidarity. Well, now God is the murderer of the firstborn Egyptians, and the people, the whole people are being chased out of Egypt. Okay, so God's solidarity, in a way, goes pretty far here. I mean, God's not a murderer. God killed, but you know, the firstborn sons of all the Egyptians are killed by the angel of death, right? And now God and God's people are fleeing out into this place of exile. I don't know what you guys think about that, but I found it striking. It's an amazing parallel that I think shows God's willingness to associate or to be associated with pretty unethical, you know, sorts of behavior.
Is it bothering them a reflection of a tribal god in a way that is for this people as opposed to the gods of the Egyptians in a way? I mean, in my mind, there's some pretty very unethical things going on here. And the emergence of a, you know, tribal gods were going from a polytheistic situation to a monotheistic where their gods are fighting our gods, and they'll kill our babies, we'll kill theirs.
Yeah, well, there's...
And invoking God, their gods to do that.
That's the darkest kind of interpretation of it, you know, which I think is possible. And, you know, and what you need to do is do kind of a comparative Semitic, I mean, ancient religious, you need to really look at that carefully, to look at whether this is just one more example of tribalism or whether there's something distinct here. One thing that we looked at yesterday and the day before, I think the day before, was how the whole function of the plagues was to bring Pharaoh to a knowledge of God. Okay, and so Pharaoh would recognize. And Moses came face to face all the time with Pharaoh, and told him exactly what was going to happen. If you don't let my people go, this will happen. This. And over there's the word. All of these plagues are there so that Pharaoh might know, and that the Egyptians might know that I am the Lord. You know, and of course, that could be read as tribalism. You know, just I don't know, as a way to kind of heavy-handed evangelism.
Yeah.
You know. But anyway, that's kind of a, I guess, a big question we got to keep out there. Okay, let's look at what happens in the wilderness. What do you think how far into the wilderness did they go?
3 days.
What does that evoke? Now there's an interesting patristics type exegesis. That would be the early church fathers. They'd say that almost to the word for word. That's good. I mean, you know, that's possible. That's a possible later way of reading it, right? But if we look at just the Exodus account itself, Moses is always telling Pharaoh, "Let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness to worship God." Right? Okay. So here they are. They've gone 3 days journey into the wilderness. What do they find? No water. Okay. I find this to be an interesting contrast to the worship as fusion mentality that we have in our, that kind of dominates out there in the society. You know, the more fusion that happens, the better the worship is. That's how a lot of people see it. And so people are leaving mainline churches and going to Four Square churches and Pentecostal churches where, you know, where the experience is a more powerful experience of, you know, of the presence. Okay, well, here what the Israelites experienced 3 days into the wilderness is what? Is the absence, okay? They come to a place of total absence, of nothing, no water. So what does that lead the people to do? Let's read those verses and see what happens exactly.
Where are we?
Chapter 15 of Exodus, verses 22 through 27.
Excuse me. Go ahead and read it. I know it. Then Moses ordered Israel to set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. That is why it was called Marah. And the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" He cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he put them to the test. He said, "If you will listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give heed to his commandments, and keep all of his statutes, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you." Then they came to Elam, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the water.
Okay, so right in the aftermath of this incredible liberation, three days from this place of liberation, at the edge of their moment of baptism, their salvation, they come to this place of no water, and that leads to murmuring. Okay, the murmuring is not against God, it's against Moses, right? So what is what's the Lord's so what happens?
Moses cries out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him how to solve the problem.
Okay. So it looks pretty easy, doesn't it? It's just like throw this piece of wood in there, and he throws a piece of wood in, and it's just like, okay. Everything's taken care of. It's there's sweet water. And what is the Lord's particular word here that follows?
It says, "Obey me or get sick."
Obey me or get sick. There's the dark way of reading it. You know, it's interesting. In Hebrew, there is no word for the word obey. It doesn't exist. And it really doesn't exist in Greek. The word, I mean, there is a word for obey in Greek that's obey your parents, but in terms of obeying God, the word doesn't exist. Did you guys know that? Yeah, so anyway, it's the word in Hebrew is the word to hear, okay? But in this case, there's two words. It's listen carefully. What I want to do is let's look at the realities of life in the wilderness that we have, that we've seen up to this point. What are they?
No water.
Okay. Okay, so another thing we see then is this call to listen carefully. Okay, listen carefully. Does not assume that we know what we're supposed to do. Right? To be in a place where you're listening carefully, you can't act until you hear, right? You're kind of in a place where you're stuck. Until you hear. And of course, oftentimes in this place of silence, people are quick to sort of invent or fabricate in their own imaginations what they think they're hearing, and to set up systems, you know, that have nothing to do with God's voice, which kind of are artificial systems, which then become objectified.
and then we're told to obey, you know, obey these rules, you know. I mean, the distinction between listening carefully or hearing and obeying is a critical distinction, because oftentimes our churches function on the obey model. Okay, and obey what? Well, you know, do this, you know. Pray every day, read your Bible, love your neighbor, love the poor, be faithful to your church, you know, be a good giver of your financial resources to the ministry of the church, help at the homeless shelter when you can, you know, whatever. There's whatever your system, whatever your denomination is, there'll be different rules. So, but listening to the voice, the wilderness is a place where listening carefully is critical. Okay? Listening carefully to the voice. He said, if you listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight and give heed is like to hear his commandments and to keep all of his statutes, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians. Okay, one way of reading that is, you know, if you're careful about following this voice, you're not going to get sick. I don't want you to get sick. You know, there's two ways of reading this. The way you were reading it is up. Read this, you know, obey me or else, you know, which is kind of our normal reaction to this kind of a text. We assume that that God is a judge. And so the rules, we have to follow the rules. If we don't follow the rules, we're going to be punished. Okay, but if we see God as a doctor, and it's a completely different feel to this, right? And that's how God is described in this text. He says, I am the Lord who heals you. Okay, this is Dr. God. He's been liberator God, and now God is revealing God's self as medicine, as a doctor. Okay, so if your doctor says, listen, your cholesterol is really high, I'm worried about you, you know, follow these rules. I mean, listen carefully. You know, don't eat such high fatty foods, you know. Get off, become a vegan, or, you know, whatever. Get more exercise and you know, do this and do that. You're not going to think, oh, that doctor's so, you know, he's just telling me that I'm not going to be healthy unless I follow his rules. And, you know, you're not going to rebel against him, right? How are you going to feel if a doctor gives you advice?
Mm-hmm. Is there any authority for that doctor viewpoint in the original Hebrew or in interpretations of it?
Absolutely. Oh yeah, absolutely. It's all over in the Hebrew scriptures. But it's a whole dimension that the Western Church has missed out on in general. You know, the Eastern Church, Eastern Orthodox Church, has developed this extensively. Okay? They have whole liturgies to Dr. God. Have you guys ever had any liturgy in your service of worship in the Lutheran Book of Worship or in any of the Lutheran liturgies that address God as doctor? You know, there may be one little mention of God as healer, okay? But Dr. God, God as physician, is a theme throughout the Hebrew Scriptures and is developed even further in the New Testament. You know, where Jesus, everyone comes to him because he heals their sicknesses, right? Okay, so listening carefully to the voice. The doctor, right? This invisible doctor brings healing, or health, I should say. So, and of course, the way that God speaks in the book of Exodus is through the mediation of the human one. Through the mediator, Moses. Okay, so what happens next in the story? Where do they arrive at the very end of the chapter? Elim.
I want to go back to this a little bit, Bob.
Okay.
With Dr. God and all of that, and the realities of the wilderness. And I don't know if you've persuaded me yet not to go back to Egypt. Because it seems like still the realities of the wilderness are... if I'm in Egypt or in the wilderness, that's hard work. Egypt is predictable. The wilderness is kind of unpredictable, right? No water. It's insecure rather than secure. My basic needs are not met, or at least they don't seem very well met. And I'm still following orders, although now you're making the orders from Dr. God, so that at least it's not kind of taskmaster orders, it's Dr. God orders. But man, with unpredictability, insecurity, and my basic needs always in question, I'm still not a happy camper. You know, why would I want to do this? I mean, I'm still not hearing much good news from the God side of view. I mean, I'm kind of like a second opinion here. And I think that's what you're saying, right? I want a second opinion. I'm not convinced that this is a very healthy prescription for me.
Yeah, well, I think freedom is, I think there's a lot of struggle involved in freedom. And it is, to describe this new life in the wilderness as in a glorious way is very dangerous. You know, so I guess you got to be thinking about the downside of life under Pharaoh a little bit. And just be sure that you really don't want to be there, because maybe if you do want to be there, you should be there. Go ahead.
I guess not to keep on this topic, but this is where I get really hung up. This whole vision of God laying down these options, basically, whether it's Dr. God or not. But I mean, then you look at God ordering, or maybe it's listen to me, sacrifice your son. That to me just seems like the most hideous barbarism. Just to see if you will, I'm going to send you out in the wilderness for 4 years to see if you're worthy, number one. And then I'm going to make you slay your son. To me, it's I have a real hard time getting over that stuff. To me, barbaric. And it seems to be a pretty literal reading. Maybe it's from my lack of understanding of the Hebrew and the original intent and things. But that's where I get stuck. I really do. Mm-hmm. And I can't accept this moral system the way I'm seeing it.
Yeah. Well,
you know, this testing. Why do you have to test someone to be adored? Why is the adoration? All that stuff. Sure.
Okay. There is a way of reading Genesis 22. The story of the sacrifice of Isaac. I wish we could do a whole study on that, because there are fascinating angles on that. One of which is the one who asks Moses. Or Abraham to sacrifice Isaac is Elohim, okay? The gods, right? And of course that was a normal practice during the time during Abraham's time. So to sacrifice your child was considered to be a good, serious believer, right? And so the whole, what's going on there is you have a total contrast. It's set up in Exodus 22 between the Elohim, the gods, and this demand, to sacrifice. And then this Adonai, or Yahweh, the Lord who reveals right at the moment as the rescuer, who says, don't do it, and who ends up, it's the angel of the Lord that rescues the child, and then the word, the final word is human sacrifice is not necessary. But anyway, there's a way of reading that text. As far as this goes, I don't know, I think wilderness describes just a state of the human, it's the human condition, it's a description of the human condition. Either you're in this situation of security, which is called bondage and servitude. The dark side of it is it's the people are groaning and they're crying out. Okay, I'm looking at the benefits of life under Pharaoh here, but the downside is something that they're forgetting very quickly, as soon as life gets tough out there in the free country. Okay, so, but one of the things that happens is they cry out to Moses, and what happens? What happens when they cry out to Moses and they complain against Moses in this verse?
They get sweet water.
They get sweet water, okay. Is there any kind of an outcry against their complaining? God would have every right to blow them away at that point. mean, here he's just liberated them. And of course, right before the liberation, it's not like they did anything that extraordinary. They cried out and they said, why don't you just let us go back? We'd rather go back and just be in Egypt. You know, and they're completely unbelieving. There's nothing that, that shows that they merit any of this liberation. You know, and does God say, okay, go back, forget this whole thing. This is what a waste of my time. You know, get out of here. Hey, Pharaoh, take them. I don't want to deal with these people. You know, no, there's this act of liberation. And God rescues them and brings them to the other side. And here they are on the other side. And they complain. And God immediately indicates a way through the issue, through the problem. Okay, so complaining, I mean, crying out and even complaining leads to God's, you know, God's faithful action. And that's confirmed by the destination of the people after, right after this point. Where do they end up? In Elim, which is the term for gods. Okay, it's not Elohim, but it's Elim. It's the place of the gods. And what is there? 12 springs of water. Okay, I mean, 12 is symbolic for like a total number, right? And it's the 12 tribes of Israel, right? So you have the 12 tribes of Israel, they each have their spring. And then what, 70 palm trees, okay? And they're by the water. So I mean, there's this incredible place of abundance. It's like they get to paradise. I mean, the Hebrew text is telling us that, okay, there they are in paradise. Now they're in paradise. So God is, this is something we see throughout the book of Exodus, is that the people, God does provide, but the people are called to this place of faith in this invisible, you know, being that looks, you know, against the odds, against all the odds. I mean, this is a place of desolation, a place of wilderness. You can't minimize that. But every time the people cry out, there is, you know, God is faithful. I don't know if that helps at all. Maybe not. Like, if we move on to the next story. If anyone has any wisdom here, throw it out, please. Let's look at chapter 16. I want to make sure we get to this part, see if this helps us any. Someone read chapter 16, verses 1 through 3.
The whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elim, and Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger.
Okay. So what are the Israelites saying at this point? Here's the first indicator that, you know, after the liberation, that they actually want to go back. That the indicator that Michael was referring to. What is it that leads them? See, they go from the Elim now, the place of the gods, the place of abundance, and they're led where? The whole congregation of the Israelites who have just benefited from Elim, they set out, and Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. Okay, now this is critical. This is the place between, two places of abundance. Okay, Elim is the place of the gods, and Sinai is their ultimate destination. Not their ultimate destination. Their ultimate destination is the land, but Sinai is the place of revelation where they're going to receive the Torah. You know, it's a critical sort of place. It's the primary destination of in the book of Exodus. Okay, so they're between the place of abundance and the place of the revelation in the wilderness of Sin. So what happens? Verse 2.
They complain.
They complain. And what do they say in verse 3?
If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, where we were filled with food.
Yeah. We sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. Okay. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Okay. Here's a very dark interpretation of the event, right? It couldn't be darker. I mean, the Israelites were always articulating the darkest interpretation, the darkest spin on what's going on. Right? I mean, they, you know, this God is not a liberating God. This is a perverse God. Now the Israelites, I think, grumble against the Lord because they expect life under the Lord to be better, to be a better alternative than life under Pharaoh. Right?
Well, that seems reasonable.
Okay.
Aren't they just people who are unbelievably hungry?
Okay, they're hungry. You know, but
they've had no food, they're terribly hungry, and maybe they can't think anything else.
Well, it doesn't even say that they're hungry here. It says that they're out. They set out from Elim. It doesn't say they ran out of water like in the previous chapter. It just says they went out into the wilderness. And the whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Okay? So, I mean, we don't really know exactly what they're complaining about at this point. But, yeah, it's lack. It's this place of lack. Definitely. We've already seen that. Well, yeah, they're referring to it in general, okay? So it's a place of lack, a place of hunger.
And they just had it so good.
Now, what kind of remembering does that, I mean, do we have here with the Israelites? I mean, is there any evidence that the Israelites sat around a bunch of flesh pots? I mean, if we remember from the first two chapters of Exodus, it is just bleak, the situation of the Israelites. It's described in the bleakest possible terms, right? I mean, they're crying out, they're groaning from underneath the burdens. The Pharaoh has just had this campaign to kill all the baby boys. They've experienced genocide. And when Moses came along, the repression got worse and worse and worse. They were given straw bread, bricks with no straw. Okay, what's going on with this selective memory of the Israelites?
The grass is always greener on the other side.
Yeah. Okay. It's like they are remembering Pharaoh as their provider, right? I mean, it's like the young. Sometimes in my Bible studies in the jail, I'll ask people about their fathers, and it's rare that I'll get anyone that will say anything negative about their father, even if some of them have never met their father, if their father was just some truck driver that drove through their village and impregnated their mother. But if their father abused them and beat them, you know, usually they'll say, yeah, my father, he beat me, but I deserved it. I was a bad little kid. You know, and then if I talk to them longer, one-on-one, and they'll tell me horrible stories of just being, you know, really seriously beaten to almost unconsciousness. And rarely will these guys criticize their fathers for that. They'll still assume. They'll say, yeah, I deserved it. Okay, so, and they'll talk about their father still with some respect and even some. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's a selective memory, right, of Pharaoh here. But on the other hand, the contrast between the security in Egypt and the desperation with Adonai, I say Adonai because that's the Hebrew way of saying Yahweh, which I think is a false way of saying God's name because we don't know how to pronounce God's name in the Hebrew scriptures. Anyway, the desperation with Adonai in the desert is very clear. And the readers invited to ask, why didn't God bring them directly to the land of milk and honey? You know, why is there this huge period in between, this place between slavery and the land? I mean, why can't we just be exited out of our difficulties and our struggles and just be brought to the kingdom of heaven? I mean, why are we on this earth in the first place? You know, why do we have to face struggle and suffer and work and have all this insecurity? I mean, why when we're baptized, why aren't we just beamed up, you know? And, and and brought to this place of abundance. I mean, I don't get it. In a way, what's happening here is the same sort of question. It's like, I want to go back. I want to go back to the security that I have. I don't want to be in this in-between place. You know, in between of slavery, difficulties, addictions, whatever our slaveries are, and this place of freedom. Does anyone have any idea about this flesh pots, what they're talking about here? I have a theory about this. Okay, what are the Israelites saying to Moses in this chapter exactly? Verse 3.
Well, they think they're going to die in the wilderness. And they say that they wish that if they were going to die, that God had killed them back in Egypt, where they were sitting with abundant things to eat.
Okay. Is there any moment when they were sitting with any abundant things to eat that you can think of in the previous 3 chapters, or 13 chapters? You know, the term being died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, okay, this contrasts radically with being brought out by the hand of the Lord from the land of Egypt, which is the imagery, the language of the Exodus. You know, they were brought out by a mighty hand, okay? And here they're talking about dying at the hand of the Lord. Is there anything that reminds you of when they say died at the hand of the Lord? Who died at the hand of the Lord in Egypt?
The Egyptians.
The Egyptians, okay. So dying by the Lord's hand evokes the death of Egyptians by the Lord's hand. I mean, there's many texts that mention that directly. The Lord's hand is associated with death of the Egyptians. Now, what about eating flesh pots, eating by the flesh pots, and eating bread to full? What does that evoke? Could it evoke the Passover? Okay, the terms are the identical terms. The flesh, there's no mention of pots, but, you know, when at the moment of the liberation, on the eve of the liberation, the Israelites are, they're eating. You know, they're eating lamb, and they're eating unleavened bread. Okay. Could it be that they're envisioning this final meal, and kind of wishing, and saying, you know, why couldn't you just taken us like you took the Egyptian firstborn, kind of at this point, you know, at this moment of the feast, you know, when we were in, you know, when we were at the eve of our liberation. I don't know. Sometimes I see this as a longing for, you know, for this, you know, for just death at the moment of fusion. I mean, death at the moment of, you know, of celebration or something. You know, rather than going out into the perils of the outside world. It's like death in the middle of our worship service on, you know, Holden Vespers or something. You know, it's like you're in the moment of worship and, you know, you're beamed out of the scene. You know, I think what I see in, I don't know about you guys, but I see what I see in so much of the popular religiosity in our county, you know, in terms of the Protestant churches, I see church as a place where people go to completely be blitzed out. It's like they want to forget everything. And they want, you know, if anything these days, religion is clearly the opiate of the people. And worship is often the opiate of the people. You know, worship can become a place of fusion that people never want to leave from, you know, to go out into the perils of the wilderness. Instead, they want to stay in this place, you know, of fullness and fulfillment. How does that strike you guys? Is there anything? Is this a possible read of this text? I'm not saying that worship has no place, you know, because this is, I mean, all of these events that are narrated in this text have a place. if we read them liturgically even. But could the flesh pots, you know, be a reference to this, you know, to this feast, to this celebration?
Well, it was a high point in their life for many, many years. Even though they were in Egypt, they were in a very desert wilderness place because they were working so hard. And they weren't probably being fed well, and they were oppressed. And so here's this wonderful moment, and then they go back out into a different kind of wilderness.
Huh.
And so this one moment takes on greater and greater significance the longer they're away from it, probably.
Okay. So the disciples, you know, when they're sitting there looking up at Jesus' dead body, or maybe they didn't even look at it, they'd fled long before that. When they're fleeing, you know, from their with all this fear in their guts, you know, because their master's just been taken and crucified, they would think, oh, if I could only be around that table again. You know, taking the body and the blood. You know, I mean, why couldn't he just exit us out? Why couldn't we just enter the kingdom right at that point? You know, there's this desire to avoid what comes after the body and the blood, right? You know, what comes after that? I mean, this moment of celebration, of remembrance, or, you know, I mean, of liberation, which is. So the death by the Lord's hand is seen as a better alternative than Moses' alternative, which is starving in the desert. You know,
they're free in the desert.
They're free in the desert, exactly.
In one way of speaking, they're not under Pharaoh's hand, but they're still not free in a way either.
So the Israelites, they want fullness. They don't want insecurity. They want fullness. They don't want emptiness. You know, Jacques Lacan, who's a Freudian, he's the modern Freudian thinking in France. He talks about how you can only desire is the ultimate human, the ultimate thing that a human is made for. Desire is what we, you know, our deepest longings. Cannot have an object. The minute they have an object that can be had, then we cease to desire. So we cease to, you know, to be authentically human. You know, the minute, and we're always looking for objects to satisfy our desire. And, you know, at any time, anything becomes objectified, and we receive. I mean, to have is to cease to be, to cease to desire, to cease to be human. So, living in the lack is what it's all about, you know, in terms of Lacanian, the ultimate place of human health is to be lacking. Okay, but who wants to lack? You know, who wants to be in a place, you know, where we're having to anticipate? I mean, lacking is a place that's painful.
How does that compare to Mexican thinking? I think it's primarily Buddhist thinking of releasing all desire, letting go of everything rather than trying to hold on to everything.
Yeah, I think there's a little difference. You know, does Buddhism is about crushing, destroying desire. I mean, it's about completely obliterating desire, as far as I understand it. But I don't know enough about Buddhism to be able to talk very, very well, very long here about this. But I understand Christianity to be something quite different. It's all about freeing the desire, you know, and being in this place of anticipation. And authentic spirituality, as I understand it, Christianity is being in a place where you're actually feeling and you're waiting and you're watching and you're discerning, you're trying to discern between that which is the artificial God or the artificial you know, whatever's going to, something artificial that's going to satisfy that desire, and the real thing, you know, and that the spiritual journey is all about waiting and watching and waiting, and trying to discern and respond to the real thing. So you're constantly in a place of expectation, you know, which is unsettling. You know, it's the place of freedom. On the other hand, you know, Elim,
the Israelites are led to Elim. Okay, the water becomes the, you know, as they wait, God does act. It's not like they're stuck in this place of total pain all the time. God does come and respond. You know, and that's why they're invited to watch and to wait and to listen carefully, okay? It's like that's the spirituality of Exodus. It's okay, listen carefully. Which voice are you hearing? Is it the voice of the free God who has liberated you, or is it the voice of the Pharaoh, you know, who is offering you hard work, predictability, security, basic needs met, following, you know, orders that are clear?
So it's like they're physically liberated, but they're not intellectually and spiritually liberated yet.
Not yet.
They carry the oppressor out to the wilderness.
They have the oppressor right in their hearts, in their guts, okay? And they want to go back. There's major resistance. They want to go back to the security that was offered, that they were experienced, you know, in slavery. I mean, this is one of the major indictments of the scriptures, is that people do not. I mean, the judgment is this, says, you know, John says in 1 John, that the people love darkness more than the light. Okay. I mean, you know, the notion of judgment in John is that Jesus exposes the darkness of the human condition, because people would rather have darkness than light. They'd rather have slavery than freedom.
Security and predictability, I would prefer to use the word certainty, because I think the big issue here is, under Pharaoh there's certainty, but it's very uncertain in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. It's completely uncertain. And I don't know if there's a better word which wraps up security, predictability, and certainty all into one word to get the meaning of all of them. But for me, what's going on in the wilderness is, here we are completely lost. We've got no clue where we're headed. And so there's no grand vision. There's no 1,000 points of light, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's very much a day-to-day thing.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's a day-to-day thing. I mean, every day I'm going to go back to my work on Sunday, this Sunday, and I'm going to think, okay, I got my jail Bible study. I mean, there's a certain amount of security and predictability, because I know what I'm going to do. I have my jail Bible study at 3 o'clock, and then I come back and I have dinner, and then I go to my ministry, our storefront, and we have a farm worker, a service with all the farm workers. And then Monday morning starts, and I wake up and I think, okay, what's going to happen? What am I going to do? And I can, I can fill up my day with many tasks very easily, right? I can very quickly think of 1,000 things to do. You know, is that what I need to really be doing? You know, maybe my job is a little different than many of yours. You have more clear descriptions of what you're to do. But, you know, my job is to reach out to people outside the churches. You know, to try to bring the good news to folks. How do you do that? I mean, you know, if I can get programmatic and use all my reason and logic and figure it out, put together a program and a system. You know, but I can easily systemize myself into a straitjacket and completely miss out on, you know, on this listening carefully part. I mean, to sit there and just say, okay, Lord have mercy, I don't know what I'm doing. I am lost out here, help me, you know, help, save, deliver. You know, mm-hmm. I'm going to watch, I'm going to wait, I'm going to humble myself and just put myself in a place, I'm going to let myself feel the anxiety and, you know, and pain of my position as a pastor. Just, I'm going to wait, I'm going to watch, I'm not going to act until I sense that it's your voice. You know, and I can choose that way, and I'm seeing that more and more as my choice, in a way. And it's very hard for me to do. It's very hard for me to be more passive, to do ministry in a more passive way. I'm an activist. You know, I can do programs, I can build all kinds of things. You know, I'm good at that. I'm efficient, I can really get a lot done fast. You know, I've been well trained as a workaholic. You know,
But if I stop and I put myself in this harder place, you know, I can relate to these feelings of the Israelites, you know. Sometimes I want to go back. I think I wish I just had a 9-to-5. So I've been longing for a 9-to-5 lately. You know, just give me a job. Show me what I'm supposed to do. I'm sick of this.
But then you got to follow orders.
Yeah, I'd like some orders. Michael?
Yeah, I think part of what we'll have to, I mean, if we keep reading on in that with Israel's experience in the wilderness and part of the things that they learn and that's starting to happen here already, is that, you know, this longing for Egypt, this longing for what we've labeled now predictability, security, certainty, is an illusion. And it's the construct, again, of, I think it was done, so, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. Because in Egypt, things were not truly predictable, secure, or certain.
No.
I mean, Pharaoh, at his whim, could say, you know, I'm not going to supply straw anymore. You get your own straw. Make your own bricks. Pharaoh decides, you know, you talk about security, kill all the male babies. It's hardly a secure situation, and on that we construct these worlds that we think are predictable, secure, and certain. But that's just smoke and mirrors.
And it's the same thing for us today. I mean, I could want a stable job with some employer. Well, I've seen all kinds of people losing their stable jobs with employers, all the downsizing that's going on in this country. I could want, you know, I could be focusing more on my IRA or whatever, making sure I'm investing in the right spots. Well, boy, I just watched the stock market go nuts. And, you know, a lot of people I know and a lot of people, I mean, my little retirement thing, you know, that it went way down. I mean, everyone's, you know, we can think we have security and we can think, oh, if I left this job for this insecure, you know, other way, if I'm trying to follow some other voice deep in me, and, you know, I don't know if any of you are feeling those things, but, you know, look what I'd be leaving. Well, maybe you wouldn't be leaving anything because the security that we think we have could be an illusion. You know, my father, he was a sort of an insecure pastor who hardly received any money. He was a free church from Sweden, and, you know, and they didn't pay my grandfather hardly anything. He had 6 kids. And my dad reacted by wanting to go the route of security. He became an insurance salesman. Okay, to talk about security, right? And an investment counselor. Well, my dad went Chapter 7. After 30 years in our home in a fancy suburb of Seattle, he lost everything. You know, everything. The same day that he had to leave his house, the car companies, you know, where he was paying off his cars, came and they repossessed both of his cars. And it was on his 65th birthday. Okay. He's not, he has no retirement at all. No retirement. So he's having to work now. He's 72, 73. You know, my dad's been, he's been preaching security his whole life. Hardcore Republican, precinct chair people. You know, I mean, I've witnessed it right in my own life. The insecurity of security. So, you know, and my parents are right, they're in the wilderness, you know, and I'm watching them grow and learn and struggle there, and it's not all black for them. I mean, there's great things that happen. Because, see, the place of wilderness is the context into which God acts. Okay, I don't want to minimize that, because chapter 16 is the famous story of the manna. Okay? It's the way God responds to the complaining is to rain bread from heaven, okay, down on the people. Okay, but it's bread from heaven. You know, and he says, go out and collect enough for every day. Well, the people, some of them collect more than for every day because they don't want to live day to day. Okay? They want to live, they want security, right? And the next day it's all full of worms, right? So life in the wilderness is life that is abundant life. You know, I mean, the Israelites experienced abundance, but it's uncertain abundance because the abundance is dependent upon someone. A being who's invisible, and who we have to, you know, we're placed in this place of faith. I think we're pretty much out of time.
Thank you.